And folks, this segment of the show is brought to you by TaylorMade Sim, featuring the Sim Driver, designed with a radical new head shape to make the driver both fast and forgiving where you need it most on the downswing. Sim irons with an improved speed bridge and echo dampening system to deliver a distance iron with forge-like feel. The Sim Fairway Woods with low CG to help you hit it higher, and a V-steel sole to launch it even easier out of any lie. Go get fit for Sim throughout the entire bag and experience the effect it's going to have on your entire game. Check it out online at TaylorMadeGolf.com for more information on the all-new Sim family. All right, now back and making his eighth appearance with me is Olin Brown. Let me remind you about Olin's background. He's from Washington, D.C., played his college golf at Occidental College out in L.A. He joined the golf team as a sophomore and gradually worked his way up to being the number one player on the team. He was named a first-team All-Conference, All-SCIAC golfer in 1980 and 1982. He was inducted into the Golf Hall of Fame in 1997, and the Golf Annual MVP Award is now named in his honor. He turned pro in 1984. He won four times on what was then the Nike Tour, now the Korn Ferry Tour. He won twice in 1991, once in 93, and once in 96. He's won three times on the regular tour at the 1998 Greater Hartford Open, which is now the Travelers Championship. Olin won that tournament by chipping in from 40 feet to defeat Stuart Sink and Larry Mize in a playoff. He also won the 1999 Colonial and the 2005 Deutsche Bank Championship. In 2005, he was named the PGA Tour Comeback Player of the Year. Over the course of his playing career, he's had five wins, 48 top 10 finishes, and 110 top 25s. Included in those five wins are two so far on the Champions Tour, including the 2011 U.S. Senior Open and the 2015 Greater Gwinnett Championship here in Atlanta. Nearly won the Chubb Classic last year. Rooting hard for him every week and looking forward to seeing him back out on the Champions Tour, and thrilled to have him with me tonight on Next on the Tee. Hey, Olin, how are you, my friend?
God dang it, Chris. After that intro, everything else is going to be a letdown. What do you do when Tiger Woods comes on the show? I mean, you got to dedicate like 2 weeks worth of his resume, don't you?
Yeah, I got to cut that one way back. Yeah. But hey,
it's like Phil
a long and illustrious career,
going,
my friend.
Yeah. That's funny.
You doing all right? How are you?
I'm doing okay, man. I'm bouncing off the walls here at home, getting ready to go back to work, though. Looking forward to it. I think, and these are hard times for everybody. It's just tough for people who are used to being active and getting out and about. Man, it's just a tough go.
What have you been doing? How have you been spending your time during lockdown?
Well, I'm going to have to buy a new seat cushion for my couch, because it's got two butt cheek indentations in it. And, you know, I'm getting out every day. My wife and I go for walks every day. We take our dog and, you know, go over to the beach. They didn't close the beach where we live, so we've spent some time over there. And I haven't honestly played any golf since the last round at Newport Beach Country Club in March. So I've been preserving my body so they wear it out before I go back on the road here for the rest of the year.
So when are you going to get back out onto the practice tee at least and you know, try to shake off the rust and get yourself ready?
Actually, I'm going to kick it into gear here this week. We go back to Colonial in 3 weeks if we're still on for it. And I have been there since 2014, and I just love that place. And really, it's nice to have an open week. It's always opposite our senior PGA, which is a tough event to pass on. And so I'm gonna go back there, and really, really looking forward to it.
So for you, when you get back out there, how is COVID-19 gonna change things? Is it gonna change things for you? Is it gonna make you think about, you know, interacting with fans or all the people, the volunteers, and the folks at tournaments? Is it gonna change your approach at all?
Well, as you know, the PGA Tour is taking a pretty proactive approach on this, and for at least the first four events there aren't going to be any fans planned, which means that they're going to be less volunteers, fewer volunteers. They won't be needed to herd the masses around the course and to help administer the event. So I think that the numbers of people on site will be greatly reduced. Now, having said that, you know, the fans are the reason that we play. So it's going to be kind of a strange feeling to be out there. And I don't think anybody really knows what to expect. And I think, you know, after what we saw last Sunday, you know, everybody's champing at the bit to get back. And we want to get back to work. We want to get back to entertaining our fans. We want to get back to playing and doing the things that we love to do. And so I think that, you know, the first week is certainly going to be, you know, like the bellwether, and we'll see where it goes after that. But I'm excited for the opportunity. I can't wait to go back at it. And I think a lot of other guys are feeling the same way.
And you mentioned it being sort of strange when you get back out there. I mean, birdie putts that fall, eagle putts that fall, a close race, you know, in a final round, and nobody there to cheer or anything. That's got to be kind of eerie, you know. That sort of a golf tournament broke out, but nobody came. How is that going to feel when, you know, from a pressure perspective, from an excitement perspective? It's got to be odd.
Well, I think the excitement will be diminished. I think the pressure perspective will still be there. I mean, everybody's going to know exactly what's at stake and what's being played for. But, you know, the fact that the fans are there, you know, adds electricity to what's going on. And I think it's going to be maybe a little bit, maybe somber is the wrong word, but something along those lines. It's going to be less than energetic, and we're just going to have to see how that goes.
Talking about this past Sunday with the Skins game, wanted to get your thoughts about that. What did you think about what we saw from Rory, DJ, Ricky, and Matt Wolf? What did you think about the play?
Well, I thought that, you know, the guys weren't as sharp as they'd want to be. But, you know, there's not just a physical component to it, you know, with the practice and all that, but there's an emotional, mental commitment to being ready to play. And with all this downtime and all this question about if and when we're going to come back, I think guys have rightly taken some time away and, you know, tried to cool their jets, maybe relax mentally so that, you know, because when we come back, it's going to be a big push and there's not going to be any time off. There's going to be a condensed season and guys are going to be pushing the limits a little bit more. So I don't think we saw their best golf. We certainly saw a lot of quality golf, but you know, it was relatively inconsistent. And having said that, you know, I think a lot of people were really excited about the opportunity to tune in and see a great old golf course like Seminole on TV, and it was great to have those four guys. Look, they're all legitimate stars and great players, and I tuned in. I watched every minute of it and I enjoyed it.
Speaking of Seminole, have you ever played there?
I played there a few times. Yep, I'm a big fan.
Yeah. Talk, you know, because the course, I mean, this is our first opportunity by our, I mean, the viewers and fans of the game, our first real opportunity to get a glimpse of what that course looks like. It looks fantastic from what I saw on television. Talk about what it's like being out there and playing it.
Well, you know, it's prime real estate. And you know what the three L's in real estate are: location, location, location. It abuts the Atlantic Ocean. It didn't show the elevation changes on TV like it is. There's a sand dune that runs through the north side of the golf course, and they're really only, I mean, I was reading some of the comments on Twitter. Everybody was saying, wow, it's just a flat Florida course. Well, in fact, there are only five holes that are flat. The rest of them are along a hillside or uphill or downhill. And, you know, it plays according to the wind. Now, they've done a lot of work on it in the last 4 or 5 years. I know that Ben Crenshaw and his partner, Mr. Coor, have come out there and kind of tried to restore Seminole to its past glory. And I think he's done a tremendous job. I thought it presented beautifully on TV, and I thought the guys put on a good show.
So part of what we saw there, the golf course aside, were four guys playing golf in shorts. When are we going to get to see more of that? I know some of the rules have changed to let you guys do that in practice rounds or pro-ams. Are we inching our way there, Owen, where at least in the summertime, you guys might be able to wear shorts?
you have to believe that it's headed that direction eventually. And certainly the commentary by and large was tremendously positive about, you know, look, the argument has been for a long time that, you know, golfers in slacks are more professional than golfers wearing shorts. Well, I don't know, man. It's hot as heck in the summertime in a lot of places, and it causes people a lot of trouble. Look, I think people want golf to take a more relaxed approach. Historically, it's been a little bit staid, and we're trying to appeal to a broader audience. I don't see any harm in going to shorts whenever the players feel like doing. The caddies have been doing it for a number of years. I don't think anybody looks at the caddies and say they can't caddy anymore because they're wearing shorts. So, you know, we just have to be a little patient, see what the triggers are that that get the tour to go to shorts whenever the players feel the need.
Well, I want to switch gears a little bit. We learned last week that the USGA is canceling qualifying for the US Open. Your thoughts on that ruling and some of the players that would typically get an opportunity that, you know, may never have another opportunity to play in the US Open that can typically go out there, qualify, and get themselves in the field. They may not get that opportunity this year. What are your thoughts around that?
Well, I mean, the first thing that you would say is, well, you know, that's really too bad. The second thing you have to say is, look, they're trying to do the best job that they can with, given the situation. I mean, they, not only did they cancel qualifying, but they canceled the bulk of their championship season. We lost the Senior Open. The women lost their Senior Open. You know, a bunch of their amateur tournaments. They're holding basically, I think it's four of, you know, their biggest events, which are the men's and women's opens and the men's and women's amateurs. And the rest of it is a casualty of the times. And really, it's really sad. It's really unfortunate because, you know, golf has a lot of constituencies. You know, it's not just those four groups, but everybody looks towards the USGA. You know, they're in the leadership capacity in golf, and perhaps they feel like they're taking the appropriate approach on this. But I would have sure loved to have seen them make a bigger effort to include the rest of their championships. Now, it's very difficult to conduct 13 or whatever championships they do in such an abbreviated time. So I can appreciate that problem. And then I think that going to, you know, whatever categories that they're going to fill the fields, is an effort to minimize, a lot of the issues that are related to this entire situation. And, I think in all likelihood, it's a one-off. I mean, unless the world's coming to an end, which is, you know, hey, at some point that's going to happen, but hopefully it's not anytime soon. I think that everybody's doing the very best that they can, and the USGA has taken this on as well as they can. And hopefully this is just one of those kinds of years where we look back and say, man, we got through that and we're back to normal the next time around, next cycle.
And Owen, speaking of qualifying for a US Open, you once shot 59 when you were qualifying back in 2005 at Woodmont Country Club up in Rockville, Maryland. Finished birdie, eagle, eagle. Take us through what it's like to shoot 59.
Well, Chris, I don't know if I've told this story to you before, but I mean, I didn't know I shot 59. I thought I'd shot 58 because I couldn't do the math during the course of the round, and I kept adding up my score going, that's 59. No, man, I shot 58. It just wasn't right. No, I just lost track. I was making so many birdies, and I finished eagle. I just couldn't add it up at the end of the day. But, you know, it's funny that you mentioned the qualifying thing and then my 59 and qualifying for the U.S. Open. I was talking to Doug Ferguson, another media guy, earlier today, and we think, he told me, we think that Michael Campbell qualified for the U.S. Open, and I was paired with him on Sunday when he won at Pinehurst. So speaking to your point about guys who aren't able to now qualify for the event, you know, there's an example of Michael Campbell having qualified vis-a-vis the European Tour or Australian Tour, whichever it was, I'm not sure. And then going out and winning the tournament, that's not going to happen this year.
Right. Yeah, I think Steve Jones did the same. I'd have to go back and look that up. But yeah, I think there was a couple of guys that have qualified and gone through and won. But to your round of 59, you thought you shot 58, you end up shooting 59. Still, That's a heck of a day. Did it at all start to become a burden or something on your mind? A lot of the things we're going to talk about on tonight's show is the mental side of the game. But did that ever start to creep in that, especially when you made eagle on 17, that, you know what, I could actually do this here?
Well, but by the time I made eagle on 17, I knew that I was going to be good enough to. I shot 73 in the morning round, and it was one of those kind of things where I hit 17 greens, and the one green that I missed, I didn't get up and down. I had a three putt, you know, and I made one birdie, and I was just bent, and I was on the verge of withdrawing, and so I signed my scorecard, and I'm throwing a fit. You know, I look, it's 103 degrees or whatever it was. My caddy was half, you know, lagging the whole day long. And I looked at the scorer or the guys on us, you know, at the scoring table, and I go, what's the right way to withdraw so you don't get in trouble? So, well, you tell us, and then we tell them, and then you withdraw. So I said to him, I go, you know what? I'm going to have lunch. I'm going to think about it. And we'll, you know, I'll make my decision. But I was pretty much done. Playing congressional later that week, and I wanted to be, it's Washington, D.C., it's my hometown. It's really hot. I didn't want to be fried out. I was already half bent from playing poorly in the morning, shooting a poor score in the morning. And so I went and had lunch. And I'm sitting there with a buddy of mine and my caddy, and I start talking about what I was doing. I think I'm going to bail. And, you know, it's 2005. My son he's 16 years old. My daughter is 13 years old. You know, I tell them things like, you know, look, it's not always going to go your way. Things aren't always easy. You know, when things aren't going your way, that doesn't mean you just pick up your toys and you move on to the next level or next place. And you got to hang in there. You got to show up. You got to put up. You got to deal with it. And I look at my caddy and I go, you know what? I thought I was going to withdraw, but I'm not sure that I can face my kids and tell them that they can never give up if I walk away now. And he looked at me and, to his credit, said, you know, oh, you're right. And so I said, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll play nine holes. And if I'm out of it, then I'm out of it. And it doesn't matter. And then we're done. And he said, okay. Well, I shot 30 on that nine. And we made the turn. I looked at old Buck and I said, we can't quit now, can we? He says, nope, we got to keep going. And I birdied a couple holes to start the back nine. And then I had a little lull. But then I finished, like you said, I finished birdie, eagle, and shot 29. And, you know, it's a sports psychologist dream, right, is to have a round like that, because I was lost in what I was doing. I had no idea what score I was shooting and how well I was playing and how easy it was, you know. And it was such a kind of like a 180 from the morning round where I played really nice golf and got absolutely nothing out of the round. And it, you know, it's one of the reasons that the great players succeed, you know, like Tiger, like Tom Watson, like Jack Nicklaus, like Phil, like all these guys who are elite players, is that, you know what, they never give into the game. Now, the game isn't always going to give you what you want. It's not going to give you always what you earn, but you got to show up. You got to go through the motion. You got to make your best effort. And when you do, all of a sudden things like that really do happen. And, you know, I had no idea really at the time how important that was. You know, first of all, 59. Okay, the 59 didn't mean that much. What meant something to me was that I qualified for the U.S. Open. I wasn't exempt at that point, by the way. I was playing on a 126 to 150 category. I was 126 or 7 that year. I can't remember. I was getting into a lot of tournaments, but it was when I got in, I could play. I didn't get always my choices, right? But, you know, going down and playing Pinehurst and then playing so well, I was leading, tied with Rockler after the first round, tied with Retief after the second round, played with Retief on Saturday. He's leading the tournament. I end up playing with Michael Campbell. He wins. I butcher Sunday. But, you know, going through that and being that far up the leaderboard at that venue in those conditions had a lot of legs. And even though I crashed on Sunday, you know, later in the year, I got into Deutsche Bank. Seth Wall gave me a sponsor, Jeff. I got into Deutsche Bank, and, you know, after 27 holes, I'm Tiger's leading after the first round. After 27 holes, I'm tied to the lead. I'm leading after 36. I'm leading tied to the lead after 54. I end up beating Jason Bohn by a shot, and I wouldn't have been able to do that without having gone through what I went through at Pinehurst, I wouldn't have been able to go. I wouldn't have been able to do that without having gone back and playing the second round of the qualifier that Monday. So, I mean, these things are all interconnected. And, you know, you get the opportunity to talk to younger players and they ask you about things that matter. You know, that's a story that I can relate to somebody that will have legs and may make a difference. It may resonate with somebody to the extent that, you know, they understand the level of commitment that it takes to play good golf all the time. And without, you know, wandering off the reservation or whatever, I mean, there was a moment when I was watching Tiger Woods way back. I mean, it's probably 18 or 20 years ago now, where he was winning Bay Hill. And it was one of those crummy winter days in Orlando. It was raining. It was in the 40s and he had the flu and he was walking off. He's to the side and, you know, he's going into the portalettes. He was throwing up and he was just feeling awful. And it occurred to me at some point during that round, you know, and watching what he was doing, because a lot of people would have mailed it in, right? They would have withdrawn or they would have shot 80 like I did Sunday at the US Open or whatever. But Tiger didn't want to lose. And in fact, he was gonna drag himself around the course. And it occurred to me during watching him play that round that he might rather die on the golf course than lose that tournament. And that's why he's Tiger Woods. That's why he's the greatest player of our generation. And you could see that with great athletes. If you watch the last dance, this thing with Michael Jordan the last few weeks, I mean, you definitely get that impression from him, from watching him. You know, there are certain athletes that are above and beyond and separate themselves from everybody else. Michael Jordan, Tiger Woods, you know, a guy like Roger Federer or Rafa Nadal, or we happen to, if you're a tennis fan, to be able to see three of the greatest players who've ever played the game all at the same time. Their careers are overlapping. Nadal, Djokovic, and Federer. It's just phenomenal. And that's why we love sports, you know, and that's why last Sunday, these four guys went to Seminole and we hadn't seen any live sports in a long while. And 2.5 million people put their eyeballs on the TV. We wanted to watch that. And this weekend up at Medalist, we can have Tiger and Phil pairing up with Peyton Manning and Tom Brady, and that's going to be an incredible event as well. So, you know, we've got a lot of good things happening. We're going to come out of this awful time. We're going to have to reboot what we're doing. We're going to have to get back after it again, and we're going to have to pull together and pull off a, you know, half a miracle to get back to life as what we used to think is normal.
Well, and just one more before I let you go, and I just want to continue that story. Because it seems like the wave that you created for yourself in that second round of the U.S. Open qualifier kind of went into Pinehurst and then went into other parts of that season. And if you go back and if you had not done that, if you had decided, I'm just going to pack it in, you know what, forget it. None of that happened. That's sort of like that sort of one thing, right? I think of it, you know, City Slickers, you know, what's the one thing? To me, that seems like the one thing for you, right? If that changed everything and propelled much more in your life.
And, you know, there's nothing saying that it wouldn't have happened. But the point that you're trying to make, and I agree with you, is that if you go through something like what I went through at Pinehurst, it wouldn't have been possible if I hadn't gone back to play the second round. And there's no question that I was better prepared for being at Deutsche Bank. And then I finished second a couple weeks later at Valero too. So, I mean, I had in a stretch there of a couple of weeks, something clicked and you know, it went my way. But there's absolutely no doubt there are moments that, and you could see them happening. I mean, you see it in the Ryder Cup or the President's Cup, you know, where players have these moments and you could see where at that moment something's happened that you could put your finger on it. You could say, well, you know, that's going to be meaningful down the road. And you've heard it thousands of times about players who have done something at an event and say, and the question is, how did you do that? Well, 4 months ago, when I was in this situation at X place, I was presented with a similar situation. And this is how I handled it. This is what happened. And I knew that I could get through it. And it translated. It traveled to this point in time where it was extra meaningful. And so this is the whole principle of commitment, right? If you're committed to something, it doesn't matter, you know, what it is, whether it's your schoolwork or your job or your relationships or your friendship, whatever it is, if you're committed and you're consistent, then those things have legs in the long run. And well, I tell you what, there are these moments that occur to people that they don't always occur to you at the moment, but sometimes in retrospect, where you can identify it and say, you know, that was the moment that meant that I understood it and I figured it out. And it doesn't always stay with you, but for that at that point, it made the difference.
Oh, before I let you go, how are things going with your son? How are things with Olin Brown Jr.?
He's doing great. You know, he's a little disappointed because there's no qualifying school this year and there's no way to get to the tour. He's gonna try and work his way onto the Corn Ferry. He played Corn Ferry last year and had kind of a miserable year where he didn't play as well as he would have liked. But you know, he's got the feather in his cap. He understands why the things went the way they went last year, and he's got that year under his belt. So what he wants to do is get back there and get to building the resume again so that he can get to the next level. Because the ideal is not, you know, that's not the end game, Corn Ferry Tour. The end game is to be on the PGA Tour. You know, that's been put on hold. So everybody's progression is a year later now, or a year delayed. And it's just the times that we're in, and you know what? Some people are going to survive that, and some people aren't. And hopefully he's going to be one of those that survives it.
Well, let our listeners know, how can they follow you both online and on social media?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Olin Brown, and I have an Instagram account. I don't even know what it is. I'm never on it. But I like talking about stuff, and if people want to ask golf questions, check it out. Well, I'm happy to answer them. And, you know, Chris, it's always great to be part of your show. Thanks for inviting me. I can't believe this is my 8th time on your show. Why do you keep inviting me back? I don't get it. We talk about
you're
the same
fantastic.
Stuff. We talk about the same stuff.
It's all great stuff. So, that's why. Every single time, there's something new to learn. And just like we just learned about, you know, what happened to you with the qualifying and all of that sort of thing, that's a fantastic story. And that's something that's going to resonate with a lot of listeners. And if we didn't have you back, like if you didn't go back for your second round, we never would have got it. So
no,
thank you so
fact.
Much for
and
sharing.
You know what? I hope it helps somebody, because you know what? Every single player of every single sport who has accomplished anything has a story just like that. I mean, every single one. So it's not unique.
Right.
And you just got to find out what that moment is and identify it and put it in your quiver and use it when you can.
Thank you, my friend. Thank you for being generous with your time and coming back again. I'm already looking forward to number 9. I hope that's real soon.
Pleasure, man. It's great being with you. Number 9 was my number in high school, so it'll be a good time. We'll do it again.
There you go. You bet. Take care, my friend. Stay safe. All the best to you and your family.
Be well. Likewise.
Thanks. See you.
Bye.
That's the great Olin Brown. That story is absolutely fantastic. And you can expect to see that in a highlight reel from this show, because that's a great story and a fantastic guy who told it. And that's sort of the thing that I try to keep in mind a lot. What's the one thing? What's the one thing from ever since I saw it on City Slickers, I keep that in mind. What's the one thing? And there it was. That's the one thing for Olin Brown. And maybe he's right. Maybe that's a theme that we need to have for future shows, and talk about that with some future guests about what's the one thing that got them where they're at, but what's the one thing that turned things around that might have been the linchpin in their careers to get them to where they got to. That's a fantastic story. I love that. Look forward to catching up with Olin again real soon. He's just fantastic. He's a treasure.